Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is the founder and CEO of Otherworld Computing, otherwise known as OWC, Larry O'Connor. But first of all, the streaming music landscape as we know it is going to change big time pretty soon. There are two big streaming companies that you probably use, or at least you've heard of, that may be completely different in a very, very short period of time. That's Pandora and SoundCloud. First of all, Pandora has a big problem because there's an investor revolt happening. So much so that the CEO and founder, Tim Westergren, is probably not going to be reelected to his seat on the board. And he saw the writing on the wall and postponed the meeting where all of that was going to happen for a couple of weeks in the hopes of selling Pandora in the meantime. And that way, if he sold, probably he would keep his job. He'd keep his job as CEO. He'd probably stay on the board if a new entity came in and bought them. So that was his roll of the dice. We'll see if that's going to happen or not. The problem is that investors are really anxious to get their money out. And Pandora has been trying everything to up their revenue, to up the number of users. But in fact, it hasn't been happening, at least at the pace that everyone hopes it would be. So there's only one company that looks like they want to buy, and that's SiriusXM. And since all of this has come out, SiriusXM has come back, or the parent company for SiriusXM has come back and basically said, well, you know what? Maybe we want to pay a lot less. How about $1 billion less than what you're asking? So it's yet to be seen whether the investors are going to go for that. It's yet to be seen whether that's actually going to transpire. But you're going to see some changes happen pretty soon. Because if nothing happens in this next 2 weeks or so, you're going to see a new board of directors. You're going to see the investors really pushing hard for something to happen there. And Pandora may change completely. Now, the second part of this is SoundCloud. SoundCloud has a really bad problem in the fact that their revenues are shot. And they don't have enough money to keep going. So they've been looking for investment of about $100 million for pretty near a year. And in lieu of that, searching for a buyer, and they haven't been able to find that either. So they were asking $700 million at one point in time. Investors have put about $250 million into it so far, including $70 million from Twitter. And now the thought is if they get anything just north of $250 million, SoundCloud is probably going to go for that. Now, what's going to happen in the meantime? SoundCloud is the big repository for indie artists' music. The problem there is they're doing it mostly for free, so it's hard to monetize those people. So SoundCloud has been doing everything it can to actually up those subscriber numbers, including a $5 tier that it just announced last week or so, and that really hasn't set the world on fire. It's hard to get people to actually change from one service to another. If you're already subscribing to Spotify, for instance, you probably don't want to go someplace else. There's not much incentive to do that. And there's not much incentive to actually subscribe to two different services, especially if one kind of specializes in indie music when you don't care about indie music. So that's the big problem. The other thing is, at one point in time, SoundCloud had 175 million users, and that was really good. Who knows what it is today, because they haven't said anything in about 3 years. So look for this landscape to change drastically in the next few months, because these two services are really hanging by a thread. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyownercircle.com. The fourth editions of my Mixing Engineer's Handbook, Recording Engineer's Handbook, and Mastering Engineer's Handbook are now available on Amazon and soon to come to a bookstore near you. You can read excerpts and find out more by going to bobbyosinski.com. The next thing I want to talk about is hearing loss in adults, which apparently is really increasing. One of the things that most people don't understand is the fact that it's the fifth leading disability in the world today. And who would have thought that it would have been hearing loss? About 15% of Americans over the age of 20 have some sort of hearing loss, but it looks like it's increasing quickly, and researchers think that it's going to go up to about 22% in the near future here, which means 75 million Americans are going to be hard of hearing. Why? Well, For one thing, it's because we're using headphones and earbuds more, playing music louder directly into our ears, and that's taking its toll. But the other thing is just the normal sound pressure level of life, and finding that more loud machinery and trains, construction equipment, and car horns and things like that are really taking its toll. But probably the biggest problem is that people aren't aware of the fact that they can lose their hearing because of this loud environment. Now, we in the music business are pretty much aware of this, and we know that our livelihood revolves around us being able to hear. So we're pretty good at actually figuring this out and taking precautions, especially lately. I see more and more musicians, more and more people in the studio using ear protection of some type. So that's a really good sign. But the fact of the matter is, some of the people that are buying our products, some of the people that are listening to us, might not be able to do that for much longer. I've been a loyal customer of Otherworld Computing, or OWC, for a very long time now. Almost every new Mac that I purchase also includes something to enhance it that I got from OWC. Larry O'Connor, who's the founder and CEO, turned his frustration with slow and expensive Mac repairs into a business selling Mac parts and upgrades and accessories in 1988. And OWC is one of the leaders in that field today. If you're a Mac owner, you're going to love this interview as Larry tells us some of the secrets of the inner workings of your favorite computer. I spoke with him via Skype from OWC offices in Woodstock, Illinois. I am a longtime customer, just a supporter of OWC. I encourage everybody that I know to go to your site and buy something, and they usually do. So
appreciate that. Why we're here, honestly.
Yeah, right. Give me some background on what you're doing or how you started, because I see on your website that it was, what, 1989 that you started?
88.
How did it all start?
All started with a simple need. I needed memory for my machine. It was a real pain at the time to go to an Apple store or an Apple authorized dealer for service. It was very expensive. You had to haul your computer in. It took several days for them to do what I would find out was really, really simple. And effectively said, you know, I can offer people the kits. I can show people, tell people how to do their own upgrades. We're going to help people do this themselves so they don't have the inconvenience that I found very frustrating. So for a fraction of the cost, I started educating folks on what they could do with their Macs. First memory, then processor upgrades, and drives, et cetera. But effectively, went from first, it was just a need. I mean, it was really frustrating and expensive to have to give up your system for several days when you could do it at home for a fraction of the cost. And it was a case, I mean, I'll tell you, I walked into this particular store. The guy, the service tech, has got his feet up on the table. I think he's reading at least a trade publication, but now, he's not looking particularly busy. It takes, 10, 15 minutes to mess with the paperwork. And then you're told, shoot, come back in basically 2 or 3 days. And you find out that, the reason it says shoot and, say come back in 2 or 3 days, it literally takes about 5 minutes to do this upgrade. That, I've spent more time to fill paperwork out than I could have done it myself for. And, learn enough to be able to share that information with other folks and, start to get into the game. And ultimately, we focus on taking technology further in general. What can we do to extend the life of systems? What can we do to take people's creativity farther, support? The stores obviously gives people the speed and the capacity to create and, for lack of a better term, dream. So it's maximizing existing hardware and having solutions that let people, do the things they need to do, to tap their creativity.
Very cool. Did you have a technical background before?
I was from a very young age, I coded and was involved. I was lucky enough to be able to have access to things I could take apart and rebuild. But that effectively was a self-taught, fortuitous exposure kind of upbringing.
That's actually good. I think I'd rather have somebody that comes from that kind of background, because you know what it's like for the average person to have to get in and do something.
So,
tell me, what happens when a new machine comes out? Do you guys get it first, before anybody else? Do you do a full tear down to see what could be upgraded? How does that work?
I can't say that we necessarily get too much before anybody else, but we're usually first on the list and typically have it lined up so that, the first minute something can be available, we've got it in our hands. And absolutely. At that point, we're tearing it apart And testing. I mean, number one, first and foremost, I mean, we get units in to make sure that all of the existing hardware we have, is working as expected. I mean, new systems aren't always perfect. There's little bugs and caveats that we need to navigate and certainly communicate to our customers that they may need to navigate, or there may be a firmware update or other support pieces. And the other half of the equation, we're tearing a machine apart as quickly as we can, short of obviously keeping it functional, to understand what's inside, what we're going to do with it, what we're not going to be able to do with it, and let our customers know on that basis as well, and look at what creative solutions we may need to come up with to carry that machine forward. I think Apple, the rewind, Tesla service, I think Apple is making it pretty, and again, you could say self-serving, we provide upgrades for these systems, but I think Apple is making a pretty significant mistake creating appliances, turning their laptops into effectively appliances that, one thing goes wrong with them, they're bricks. You run out of storage, they're done. That sort of aspect. I mean, that sort of the kind of cost that people, are expected to put into a machine, it kind of comes with an expectation of a lifetime for that machine. When I talk to creatives, especially any folks that are in business, they can't, it's not a matter whether they can or they can't, but they have a very hard time accepting that they're going to spend this kind of, put this kind of capital into a machine that as soon as the video card or the memory or certainly the storage doesn't quite serve a present day need, they have to go out and buy a new system. It's a real sore spot with the Mac Pro of 2013, especially with the GPUs. You can upgrade GPUs still in the 2012s. You can put in some for certain applications. I mean, different type of GPU base. You can put better, stuff into a 2012 Mac Pro than you can into a 2013. And the 2013 is really got a lot of great capability, but all that is locked into a 2013 design. The GPUs are now 4 years old. Now the processors are 4 years old. The memory is limited to 4 slots, and we go to 128 in there, but 128 is a max. 64 is technically the factory supported. They built a machine that in terms of its form is beautiful, but didn't have legs in terms of longevity. And it's Apple wants this. My understanding is Apple wants this 2-year replacement cycle on systems that historically users have been willing to spend, they make the investment in, because they last a lot longer than 2 years. And you have folks that go through a 2-year cycle, but the other piece of the equation, because of upgradability, these systems have maintained a really good value on the resale side. So somebody who did want to replace every year, 2 years, and people used to buy, there used to be meaningful reasons to buy a new Mac every year or so, because every year could be a big leap. And it really hasn't been the case the last few years. But to the main point, the machines held their value to where you were still getting 70-80% of what you paid a year and a half, 2 years ago when you went to buy something new. Today, where these systems are fixed, especially the ones that ship out with either a small SSD or limited memory. Limited memory is the biggest killer. They're losing a substantial part of their value, within the first year, maybe 30, 40, 50% even within a year, because of the limitations and the lack of ability for somebody that you can't overcome it. Now, we have solutions for storage on everything up to 2015, but these 2016s, anything right now, somebody buys and walks in, and most people, especially consumers, they don't understand necessarily what they're buying. That they may be, that they, and they're, quite frankly, all their friends' machines are upgradable. Historically, systems have had some upgradability. When they walk out with a machine that's got a 256 gigabyte SSD in it, and 6 months later, they find out, I'm kind of out of space, my machine's slowing down, I've got to go back to the store, hey, can I get a bigger drive? And the answer is, sure, here's the next one, the next computer you can buy for another $500 on top of what you paid for this one. Well, what do I do with this one? I can go eBay it, sell it. We can recycle it for you, but that's probably not a good idea. It's not a good thing.
I come from the music industry, and the number of people that I meet recently that will tell me, I just got a new computer. Well, what'd you get? I got a 2012 and it's really hot rodded. And there are now cottage industries that are springing up that weren't there before, a few years ago, just hot rodding those particular machines for audio and video pros. I know what you mean. And you know what? They would sell a lot of machines if they came out with a brand new Mac Pro that was upgradable. They'd be flying off the shelves to creatives. I know. I'd buy one. I'd buy two right off.
All I remember, I'll tell you, everything that we ever heard back in 2012, 2011, once Thunderbolt was out, people didn't care about a new platform. They wanted a Silver Tower with Thunderbolt. That was it. Give us the Silver, take us to the next processor generation and give us Thunderbolt and USB 3, but give us the next generation with Thunderbolt. They didn't want the ICANN, which, people want to term it. And again, an engineering marvel, but it was, from a serving the functional needs side of the equation, Apple can pat themselves on the back for, an amazing engineering feat, what they did in that machine. But in terms of what creatives wanted, what the market, I certainly believe, wanted, it did not meet that requirement. And today, especially, where you have a machine that, the only way to do certain upgrades for that would be to effectively violate DMCA. It's got some real challenges when you now have a platform that's not going to be updated every year. I mean, here's a machine now going into its fourth year, and there's really very little you can do to improve some things that are modern day shortcomings. So I agree with you. I mean, you give people a real pro MacBook, give people a real pro Mini for all practical purposes. The Mac Mini 2012s, the Quad i7s, today go for, in a lot of cases, they sell for more than they sold brand new, because there's nothing. I mean, you don't have the flexibility or the quad. You can't even get a quad core Mac Mini today. I understand Apple's in this interesting thing where they say the pros are such a little niche. They're not important to the. They're not a big enough slice of the revenue. But I'd argue, number one, they're still a significantly important piece of the equation, and even beyond whatever pros directly buy. The influence that pros have over other non-professional users is tremendous. And when the pros are not out there evangelizing, pros went from being unbelievably and gung-ho about Apple to, still defensive about Apple, but not quite as excited. Now, then they became apologetic. And we kind of still keep the faith to today. There's just, Apple still has, arguably, the absolute best platform, period. For what, whether it's audio, video, it's by and large, it is a platform that offers benefits that are far from being met on the Windows side of the equation. But they're making it a lot harder than it has to be, and they're making it easier for pros to find reasons and find ways to accept the shortcomings on the Windows side, or even go to Linux, just on the simple basis that some of these machines just don't have the horsepower. They have a choice of. They really have the choice of going to Windows and getting the horsepower they need, or doing a Hackintosh, which has its own significant caveats in addition to being unsupported and not legal. So it's an interesting place that Apple's in today, and they're kind of self-fulfilling. I mean, they continue to say that the pros don't make up aren't an important portion of their revenue stream, but for the last 4 or 5 years, much of what they've done, effectively they've been taking things away. That the pros needed. And these latest 2016s where they went to, and again, I think in a few years it's going to be great, where wireless technology, there's going to be all sorts of great things that make what Apple did in 2016 the right move in the future. But it was too soon to take away the ports that everybody depends upon. I mean, just the basic USB type A ports. Thin is great, but I would argue on the pro side, actually based on the DECT product that we introduced, which is going to make these machines as thick as a 2012 again, or as thin as the 2012, however you want to look at it. There's great excitement over that because it brings back, it gives storage again, it gives Ethernet, it gives USB type A's, card reader. They took the card reader away.
Yeah.
It was either 2010 or 2011 when Apple brought that card reader into the machines, when they actually put the simple, personally, it wasn't a big deal to me. I mean, I don't mind having the separate adapter, but they got cheers around the world. All the tech sites, right? Hey, Apple finally put an SD reader. Under their laptops, and now they've taken it away again. So I guess my main gig would be functionality for a pro. You guys need things to be functional in the field. We all need things to be functional in the field. We don't want to carry 20 different dongles around. Thin is nice, but only if it accommodates what we need for our daily workflow. And when you go thin and take away those workflow things, it's really counterproductive. It's more steps backwards than it is forwards. To say, and all the PC guys that went, that migrated laptops to Type-C kept other ports on the damn thing. They didn't go so thin that they couldn't have Type-A ports, for example. The MacBook Pro, and I'll leave it at this. The MacBook Pro 2016, in my opinion, is a, you know, it's a consumer computer that's aimed at pros, or it's a, how do I say it? It's a very overpriced pro system that's aimed at a high-end consumer. But it certainly lacks the things that most pros, you know, how do I say, are desperate for.
Does Apple listen to you?
You know, I think certain folks within Apple do, but I think Apple has its own. I mean, I don't think Apple listens to its own internal core. Now, looking at, you know, some of the design things and things that, you know, that definitely have, you know, it could have been made things harder over the years in certain areas. Now, trying to leave some opportunity, I do believe if Apple listened to its, you know, how to say, to itself, we'd see something different. But the short answer is, yeah, not, they don't listen. I don't think they listen to anybody, but you know, whatever, you know, blinders on path, I would say they've been on.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's get a little geeky for a second here. Tell me about the differences between Thunderbolt and USB-C, and what is better in your opinion?
Well, first off, this whole Type-C thing is probably one of the most confusing interface transitions of all time. You know, Type-C is technically just a connection. It's not actually the interface. Now, you have over Type-C, you have USB 3.1 enabled ports. And what comes with all Type-C ports, and this is USB 3.1 and Thunderbolt 3, is power delivery and power management. So the first thing I say is you can look at the MacBook, which has just 3.1 Gen 1, which is the same speed as classic USB 3. In a Type-C interface. And then on the new MacBook Pro 2016s, we've got the Type-C ports, which support both USB 3.1 and up to Gen 2, as well as Thunderbolt 3. So you can plug a Thunderbolt 3 or a USB 3 device into those Type-C ports. So that I say, in fact, you can plug a USB 3.1 device into the back of any USB device into the tail of a Thunderbolt 3 chain as well. With the new, the chipset works. So if you have a machine that supports Thunderbolt 3, you automatically support USB 3.1. But if you have a machine that only supports USB 3.1 with Type-C, it's only USB 3, it doesn't support Thunderbolt. As far as to answer your question, which is better, Thunderbolt 3 provides, you know, 40 gigabits. You know, it's a PCI extension. You know, effectively it's PCI over copper. In terms of performance and just the interface and the latency, Thunderbolt is Thunderbolt rocks. USB is still, you know, how to say, especially USB 3.1 Gen 2, which supports up to 10 gigabits, which is the same as the original Thunderbolt. There's a little more overhead on it, but in terms of a very robust, cost-efficient interface, it's absolutely solid and certainly far more solid. Although the standards are all over the place and there's still some things that there's some moving ground, you know, it's far more. USB 3.1 Gen 1 and Gen 2 have far better standards than the previous 3.0 interface on previous generation systems. So depending on what your needs are, both now can serve really, really well. Thunderbolt, though, is designed to be more of Thunderbolt truly is a more professional, it's effectively almost an enterprise-class connector. There's heavy certifications for it. How Thunderbolt 3 behaves is highly regulated. Through certifications, not every Tom, Dick, and Harry can just come out and release the Thunderbolt 3 device. And as a result, you know, the expected function you get over a Thunderbolt is consistent. Now, you don't have to worry about variables that you still have to worry about with USB devices, where anybody can release a USB-C device. Now, power delivery isn't consistent. You know, there are hubs that don't work right. There's all sorts of things that don't work right because it's more voluntary. All of our Type-C devices are held at extremely high standards, and we go through certification, and we interface with power delivery. Now, we do it correctly, but unlike Thunderbolt, there's nothing that forces a manufacturer to take the extra steps to make sure their device has proper compatibility support and interfaces, you know, with the different USB, 3.1 features, if that makes sense. Thunderbolt, if it's a Thunderbolt device, you can always expect it to work a certain way. It would not be released. It would not be a shippable device if it did not.
One of the problems with Thunderbolt that I see, and I have it here, and I've talked to other people that have expressed the same thing, is the fact that there's no Thunderbolt hubs. And there are devices that don't have two Thunderbolt I/O on it. So, you know, sure. You get one at the end of the chain and you're done. So it would be really nice to have a hub, but I guess that'd be expensive, right?
It can't be a hub. It's got to be a switch because you're talking PCIe lanes. It's not just a simple, sharing of the bandwidth. You know, it's a different kind of interface, a different level of performance and expectation. As far as single-ended devices, the only things that really need to be single-ended are bus-powered devices. You know, there's only enough power across the Thunderbolt bus in a certified case to support one bus-powered device. So that has to be at the end of the chain. Anything that has two ports on it is required to provide power upstream equivalent to the port of the computer. So everything that we have is not bus-powered, has two ports on it. And if you need more than two devices, you're going to have external power. And that would be the same case with the USB as well. So if it's, you can hub USB, but when you're hubbing USB, and this is where people have problems, especially if it's a bus-powered hub, that's where you get into trouble with what you connect into it. So Thunderbolt is, again, the one, you can't hub it, granted, but if it's a single-ended device, it's because they saved money because they didn't want to have to deal with the upstream if it's an externally powered product. Or it's a bus-powered product, and that should be at the end of your that should be at the end of the chain anyway. And if you need more than one Thunderbolt device, you ought to be you're going to need to have something with power. And honestly, with USB Type C, you're in the same boat. Mm-hmm. If you need more than one bus-powered device there, you really should, given the performance you get off of USB and how much power draw the higher performing devices draw off Type C, you should be you're going to need external power. So it's less a limitation. It's more a protective matter in terms of, again, maintaining, ensuring that you have good operation. You can't just plug in a hub with four ports and start plugging other devices into it and hope that it works, or the manufacturer doesn't really say what works, and then you're frustrated because you're online, everything's going well, and then someone else starts to draw power, and all of a sudden you have a device drop without warning or even a good explanation as to why. So,
I've had that happen before. Yeah, that sounds familiar. Yeah. I know it's more difficult now with the newer Macs because you're not able to do as many upgrades as you could before. But generally speaking, if someone wants to build a audio or video workstation, what's the best thing that you could do to optimize that?
What Apple ships off the shelf is pretty solid. In terms of what you can today, even in the 2016, the big thing is making sure that it's got the connections that you need. I mean, we offer docks that provide effectively the connections that Apple doesn't give you from the factory. But more so than anything else is in a system where you can't upgrade the memory, making sure you have that maximum, typically 16 gigs of memory. Don't skimp and get 8 gigs because that'll bite you in the tail. At some point, it also affects resale value substantially. And make sure you have the storage that you need. But there's not much you can do. I mean, on the pro side, these machines, what you're shipping, they're pretty well as optimized as there's more, especially for audio. There's more horsepower in these systems than we really need. I mean, you don't need a brand new system. And then you talked about 2012s earlier. 2012 i7s have more than enough juice to do what folks need. And they have the flexibility in terms of being able to make sure you have a solid state drive, make sure you have memory. You can do all these things with those machines. And you can connect the dock, additional ports and additional capabilities that the machine may not have, even going back to 2012, where you actually had a few interfaces still built in.
Speaking of solid-state drives, so they seem to be taking over, and rightfully so. How long do you think before old-fashioned mechanical drives are kind of dead in water?
There may be something that replaces mechanical drives at some point that's high density and not quite at the speed of solid state, or who knows, a brand new disruptive technology. But in terms of saying goodbye to spinning platter drives, I don't think we're going to see that for a very, very long time.
Really?
Flash is still very expensive relative to the cost per gigabyte on a spinning drive. And you just don't need flash for a lot of things. I mean, when you're already at real time in a lot of playback, if you're doing archive, there's plenty of things where flash gives you no benefit and it comes at a much higher cost. So even on the video side, you can array spinning drives together and do incredibly fast editing, 4K editing. In fact, even on Thunder Bay, eight drive arrays across using two of the devices. So these drives have a lot of legs left in them in terms of the spinners, just on the basis that 40 terabytes, and that's it's a pretty high density on the for an external spinning solution is under 3,000 compared to about 40,000 to do the same today with SSDs. And granted, that right now, there's literally a shortage on the flash. You know, flash demand went through the roof mainly because of mobile devices. And for the last 6-7 months, there's actually been shortage and price increases on the cost of flash. It's been a real interesting landscape, and that'll reverse. I mean, that'll give another 6 to 9 months. Hopefully it's not longer than that. We'll see things normalize. You know, the new 3D MLC and all the transition, all the, the geometry transitions and the yields come back up. But, you know, the long and the short of it is over time, we should continue to see flash declining and densities going up. But, you know, the same thing continues to happen with hard drives. And unless you need the flash, I mean, there's not really, you know, for a boot drive, I mean, for a quick, you know, for the volume that you work off of, you know, I think a flash drive, you know, an external flash drive is a great means to back up your system, have something you can boot really quick off of. Even for portability, if you want to, you know, have a clone and be able to go to another place and plug in without having to bring your setup. But in terms of, you know, longer-term archiving and additional backups, you know, historical, whatever you may want to say, especially on the video side, flash gets very expensive very, very quickly, especially with 4K, let alone 8K video. In terms of the space, audio is a little easier. It takes up a lot less space, but, you know, once again, you know, it just comes down to what you can get a 1 terabyte hard drive still for, you know, run external plug and play, good to go for around $100. A 1 terabyte flash drive is 4 times that cost.
Yeah, right.
So it's a lux. And unless you, again, you look at hitting and editing going through, you know, there's definitely a benefit. But for if you're playing back video or playing back audio, a hard drive from 10 years ago was fast enough to play back audio. You know, you can put the fastest thing under the sun in front of it, and there's not it doesn't change, you know, real time, experience.
Right. I'm curious, is Newer Tech one of your brands?
Yes. Newer Tech is a sister company within the organization. Focus more on the consumer side. And solutions and things and help you outs, battery upgrades and such.
Yeah.
Whereas OWC has a bigger focus on the iMac upgrade kits, the SSDs, and anything for consumer up to even enterprise and data center storage.
Okay. What's the best-selling product that you have, just out of curiosity?
You know, it depends upon the category. I mean, broadly, storage is our best-selling, product. Our solid state drives, you know, are a huge piece of the equation. You know, we're upgrading. We still support machines, you know, going back more than a decade and up to, of course, 2015. And external solid state, especially as you get into the external Thunder Bay, the mini arrays, you know, another big, big area because they're extremely fast. Once again, you can do, they're incredibly, incredibly function ready. But solid state drives are still, you know, a large percentage of the user base out there that are working off of, booting off of a spinner. And some of those drives are getting, I mean, some of these drives are really old. I mean, 2008, 2009, 2010, the machines, are, you know, they do everything that, you know, the user needs them to do, but they're still on a spinner. And it's such a, it's without buying a brand new machine for such a very low cost, you put in an SSD and you have a brand new machine. So SSD continue to be giant. Plus just pure storage. I mean, the MacBook Airs, the MacBook Pro Retinas, you know, you got folks with 128, 256 gigs of storage that are finding out some people, I mean, I literally walk in, whether it's on the street or in an airport, and somehow a conversation comes up. For the first time, they find out that they can upgrade that to something bigger. And now they're excited to be able to put in a 500 or a 1 terabyte SSD and extend that the life of that machine and have a little more storage room without having to buy a new machine.
Well, okay, that brings up a question then. You mentioned some people have a hard drive that they're working off of, a spinner from 2008, 2010. Would it be a good idea to replace that? Is it running up against its lifespan?
I would say yes to that. I would absolutely say that that's a special machine that's being used on a daily basis. I would suggest, I'll say two things. Drives from a decade ago, just because of the densities, just the platter media, you know, tend to be more robust. I won't say that they were less complicated, but they really were less complicated. There's not so much data being packed so close together as they do today. But, you know, a drive that's, you know, getting, you know, five plus, I mean, after 3 years, you know, if it's mission critical, I mean, this is your livelihood depends upon it, or it's a machine that's important to you. it's a pretty low cost. I mean, you change your oil in your car, you know, that costs, you know, you do that several times a year. You know, a hard drive costs less than that. You know, replace the drive. Either you're just going to replace a hard drive with another hard drive. So after 3 years, it certainly is not a bad strategy to replace that drive. You know, put the old drive in as an external, use it as a backup. You don't have to, it's not a matter of throwing it away. But, you know, especially as you get into 5-6 years plus, you know, it's a good time to be considering a replacement just because it is a maintenance item, is a just as a smart thing to do. You don't want to be surprised, forced to replace something.
I have a library filled of drives, and usually I'll use them for a project. I'm not the only one. Everybody's kind of like this. So use them for a project, and then you pull it out and you archive it, and the drive sits there forever and ever until somebody asks for it. What is the lifespan, if that's the case? I mean, I have 10-year-old drives that, you know, have effectively 2 or 3 months of spinning time on it, work time. So if that's the case, is it worth replacing those?
No. I would always recommend to anybody you have more than one backup. There should be no single point of failure for any piece of data that has any value, just on the basis that there's plenty of things. I mean, even you know, location wise, I mean, your data shouldn't all be, you know, in the same location. But in terms of, you know, the lifespan, I have a drive. Yeah, you know, I think it's behind me. I'm not sure where it's sitting right now. Anyway, drives last. In terms of the physical aspects, you know, I'm less concerned with a drive that's sitting, you know, not working. This is more a drive that has hours on it, that has start and stop cycles. Drives with light use that have been used for archive purposes, I wouldn't worry about replacing those so much as I'm mainly talking about drives that have wear and tear on them.
Okay, good to know. Okay, last question. What is the best piece of business advice that maybe you received from somebody along the way, or maybe you learned yourself? Considering that you started the company basically from scratch, so you must have had a lot of lessons and all that.
Yeah, there's certainly been plenty of lessons along the way. You know, the biggest thing is, you know, quite frankly, is that invest in yourself, believe in yourself. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, and I look at Silicon Valley, I look at all these startups and everything out there where they go, and their whole motivation is, you know, they go through the Series A, you get through the Series B. Hopefully there might be a product someday that, you know, it might make, you know, might actually be able to support itself. But, you know, any business, I mean, I would think the focus is, hey, I mean, if it's going to be viable, it has to be able to support itself. Make sure there's a model that, you know, provides something of value to, you know, the customer. I mean, ultimately who is going to be paying for the service, and ensure absolutely positively that you can do so in a manner that, you know, the business supports itself. Now, if you're dependent, if your whole gig is, and again, I know there's businesses out there that can, you know, get away with this, and it's amazing just the flow of capital that's out there. But, you know, to me, I mean, if it's worth doing, I mean, you know, believe in it, stay focused on it. You know, this is, and make sure that you can, it's profitable to where you can reinvest in the business. If you can only tread water, you know, it's going to be hard to get anywhere. You know, and quite frankly, again, you know, expect, as I say, to pay people more than yourself, you know, when you're building a business and expanding, because that's the only way that you can build and grow. As long as you keep it going back into the business, you can build, as I say, a successful business and support your customers right. But, you know, I'm a big, I have zero understanding, you know, for, you know, the typical startup cycle, which, you know, maybe 10 years after they've started, now there's somebody actually looking at, you know, how does this business pay for itself, as opposed to how do we justify customers and revenue so that we can raise more capital to support our losses.
That's a great philosophy, and I can see why you're successful with that. And you could tell. I mean, it comes out in everything about OWC, just from the website, the feel of the website, the emails that come out. Speaking with you, looking at the NAMM Show exhibit, you get the feeling that you're there to help people, and certainly it comes across like that. Feels good.
I appreciate that. You know, be fair to folks, and, you know, they'll be fair to you. And, you know, always keep urgency. I mean, that's, and the last big thing is, you know, never ever take trust for granted. I mean, we're always, you know, working to earn at a safe place. We don't, you know, assume anything. I mean, yeah, everybody's important, and you know, we have to, you know, we have a responsibility. I say to do the best that we can do always. And that's, you know, again, trust is earned, not ever taken for granted.
For more info on OWC, go to maxsales.com. That's all one word, maxsales.com. I highly recommend it. I buy a lot of stuff from them, and I'll continue to because they have great products that are very high quality. Thanks for listening to Be My Inner Circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.